My nightly ablutions always involve a walk in my PJs past my fellow campers, bearing wash kit and towel, to a communal concrete building that is generally uninviting. The wash blocks are all the same, and all different, in a way that makes absolutely no difference. They are generally smelly, and the floors are always wet, no matter what the time of day it seems. Some have showers that must be paid for with a coin, others use tokens, and others still provide hot water free of charge, though only at peak time in the mornings and the evenings. They are usually open to the air in some way, and they may be busy or deserted according to some habitude among the camping fraternity, or maybe a shared French custom, like the time one eats, lunchtime being sacrosanct, and remarkably consistent wherever you go in this country. They will resent me saying so, but there's a conformist instinct in the French, perhaps a symptom of a certain chauvinism, and a conscious sense of a shared culture that we English lack. Or maybe we have our national characteristics, but disrupted by the persistence of a class-riddled society that continues to make customs like tea and dinner mean very different things to very different people. The great leveller for all nationalities is to share this utilitarian sanctuary where you strip off your clothes, shave, shower, go to the toilet and clean your teeth. Wash blocks remind us of our common humanity, and I often find myself alone or with only one or two companions. I'm not at all sure companions is the right word. My French is not good enough to hold a conversation of any length or depth, but the etiquette of these places is not geared towards getting to know one another, and that's a relief. I'm learning that in lieu of passing the time of day, a clipped bonjour is as far as you should go in acknowledging anyone you meet at the basins or making their way to and from the stalls or the showers. More often, a nod of the head, or better still, no expression at all, is perfectly acceptable, even preferable. Tonight, I feel no small satisfaction in the achievement of the day. 50 kilometres. According to the sat-nav on my phone, the one I swore I wouldn't use, 52.4 kilometres to be precise. I've reached Vieux Saint-Girons, and I'm staying at a campsite called Camping Urosol. As I walk back to my humble home, past the elaborate smoking barbecues, I sneak a look into the cosy interiors of oversized white camper vans and caravans as I pass. Their occupants ranged around tables and a good old-fashioned electric light, and I feel a twinge of envy. But as I make my way back from what was a very hot shower to see my tent glowing softly in the distance, lit by my solar lamp, the mattress fully inflated under my crumpled sky-blue down sleeping bag, I'm quietly proud to be here, to be alone, and to be all right. When I get back, I pack my wash kit in the left-hand pannier ready for the morning. I hang my damp towel out, knowing it won't dry tonight, but positioning it as best I can to catch the first rays of sun in the morning. I'm wearing my version of pyjamas, cotton harem pants and a t-shirt, and debating whether to leave both on as I unzip the tent, at least until I warm up in the sleeping bag. It costs something to bend my aching legs and get so low to the ground at the end of a long day. But I'm ready to be horizontal. Though I know I'll sleep soundly for a few hours, only to wake in the night and doze fitfully until morning, I've never been a good sleeper. Meg's inherited insomnia from me, even as a baby. She didn't sleep through the night for the first 2 years of her life. Not until we took her into our bed and she lay between us, comforted and happy. And whilst my ex-wife, who was a very good sleeper, or was then, was barely conscious of the warm little body between us, I clung to the edge of the bed and waited, open-eyed, for morning. Not that I held a grudge. Now Meg's is all grown up, sleep still doesn't come easy, and Lily, who used to be able to sleep anywhere, is finding it harder and harder too. We all worry too much, it seems, to run in the family. I try to encourage sleep to come by thinking back on the day. It is true to say that I have spoken to very few people beyond those at receptions or in cafes, poor souls who've had to endure my schoolboy French. I have been alone for quite a while now, so much so that when I did strike up a conversation today, the experience was exhilarating. not least because I realised I had seen this young man 2 or 3 times before. Somehow, as we rode the same path, we had overlapped and begun to recognise each other with a nod or a wave. I would pass him, and he would pass me. What was so distinctive about him was the ragged straw hat perched on his head that gave him the casual air of a peasant on the way to the fields to work, or an artisan taking a break from his atelier. I had my own straw hat, but not half so chic, nor could I compete with his air of insouciance and, well, ataraxia. We spoke for the first time when I stopped to take a closer look at the Second World War bunkers that still litter this coast, part of the Atlantic Wall, built by the German army to deter invasion from the sea by the Allies. I read that these stranded monoliths, many sliding into the sea or tipped at odd angles by 80 years of slippage in the sand and the pounding of the waves that will one day make them vanish, hopefully, but the process is slow. Some have graffiti, one or two still contain rusting machinery, and I saw a picture of one with a gun barrel poking out through the concrete slit. To see them is to remind yourself of war and conflict, but also to see the slow-motion ability of nature to absorb the worst of us, to bury the evidence in sand and sea, and to make a nonsense of our temporary stewardship of this planet. I read somewhere that there is so much concrete in the world that it will one day outweigh all living matter. That's every tree, every fish in the sea, every bird in the sky, and every one of us, not to mention whales, hippos, rhinoceroses, grass, and every last insect, even the ants. And not to mention lichens, mosses, I could go on. More than half of all human-made things are made of concrete, and in 1,000 years or more, when the ants look back on the brief reign of the bipeds, who were so amusing to persecute, all they will have to remind them of us will be crumbling concrete. Which is why my home, be it ever so humble, will not be built with concrete. I was musing on all this as I repacked my bike, having lunched on the beach, when the young man parked his own bike beside mine. He nodded to me congenially, and when he saw me struggling with the language, he kindly spoke in English. He had a faraway look and a calmness about him that was attractive. We chatted easily about my trip and his journey from his home, somewhere near the sea, close to Montpellier. My 1,000 kilometres pulled beside his plan to cycle around France, tracing the Spanish border, working his way up the Atlantic seaboard and hugging the Brittany coast before heading south again via Paris, Dijon and Lyon, a total of some 3,000 kilometres. But what surprised me most was that he travelled so light, with only a sleeping bag and a tiny one-man tent, and he told me he never stayed in campsites. Too expensive, he said. When I asked why he was making the trip, he said simply, I want to see my country. He didn't seem to feel any further explanation was necessary. He planned to become an engineer and would begin college soon. He appeared to both embrace and accept his fate without question, in a way that suggested a well-thought-out philosophy of life beyond his years. We parted as straightforwardly as we'd met, with a bonne chance, bon voyage, and as I watched him go, I felt envious of his ease with himself and his ability to make do. I can't remember being the same when I was 18 or 20, though I suppose it's possible it seemed that way to others. I didn't ask his name, nor he mine, appropriate to the etiquette of anonymity between fellow travellers. But the encounter lingers. It's as if his youth reminds me of another me, less inclined to fear and woe, more open to things as they are, and with less accumulated experience making me wary about what is to come. We all of us have a natural disposition, of course, but I think many of us lose something precious in making life's journey, even as we understand more about the world and more about who we are. We lose our innocence. Perhaps it's as simple as that. As I lie in the dark of the tent, I hear the occasional voice speaking in French or sometimes German or Dutch as my fellow campers retire for the night. In the enveloping quiet that follows, the warmth of the sleeping bag and the chill of the night air are just sending me off to sleep when I realise there is something crawling over my face. I scrabble for the torch, carefully positioned beside me for just such an emergency. Only I can't find it. Perhaps it's rolled under the self-inflating mattress. I lift one buttock, lean on my right elbow, and scrabble with my left hand. Nothing bar the stones and pine cones that I can feel under the tent. I really ought to have swept them away more diligently when I made camp. I repeat the exercise, this time leaning on my left elbow and patting the ground sheet with my right to find a tube of cold steel. Got it. I flick the switch and scan all around me. Tent sides, clothes, and what about my pillow? Could it have been a mosquito? I lie back and scan the apex. There's a bug, but it doesn't look like a mozzie. It doesn't look like it moves around very much. Sans wings, anyway. I sweep the beam over the ground sheet once again, a searchlight seeking out intruders, forcing them into the shadows, all bar one solitary ant, rather bigger than I'm used to at home, and clearly pretty sure of himself. I wonder if he's too fast to catch, or worse still, too big to kill. I'm alone. I have to judge this situation for myself, morally and pragmatically, but in my own best interests. I consider reaching for one of my sweaty old trainers, left outside the tent for obvious reasons. But that means unzipping, and that might encourage more intruders, especially with a torch on. I opt for a soft barrier of clothes, a mini mountain, a whole landscape for him to explore, and a barrier between my sleeping position and his last known position. One ant, an infestation, doth not make. I have to man up. I lie back and check the time. Almost 4. I need another couple of hours to face the day ahead. I'm exhausted. And suddenly fed up, too. What am I trying to prove by being here? That I can still hack it? Let it go. I'm learning to let go. That's why I'm here. I put the inflatable pillow back in position, careful to keep it away from the tent sides to avoid condensation seeping through the fabric. I wrap my sweatshirt carefully over the pillow to create the illusion of a real pillow and not a squeaky balloon. And I pull my sleeping bag up as far as it will go. I lift my bum for one last tug on the excess material gathered around my hips, curl my legs, and lie on my side, holding the covered pillow in place with one hand until I hopefully nod off. It's then I hear a sound I've not heard before, the unmistakable hiss of air escaping under pressure. My self-inflating mattress is now self-deflating, matching my mood, and the surprisingly cold, stony ground of the forest floor is rising to meet my warm old body, the icy embrace of the grave.